It's a really hard job. I mean, I cry a lot, as we've discussed. I talk to my mom a lot. I have a therapist. Like, it's a very hard job.
Yeah.
However, the privilege of being allowed into people's lives at their hardest and most horrific moments is so beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I am not a religious person. I am atheist. So I tend to believe that everything we have is here right now. And so I just think this is spiritual. Like, I think this work is spiritual.
Hey, Shelly.
Hey, Meegs. How are you?
Good. Back for another episode.
Yes, we are. Season 4.
Dream City Dreams.
The podcast where we interview Milwaukee women who are doing dreamy things.
Dreamy things, incredible things, important things.
Oof, yes.
Like today's guest.
Dr. Megan Schultz, who we learned about through an op-ed in the Journal Sentinel.
Yeah, many op-eds.
Many op-eds, yes. She's a ER pediatric physician at Children's Hospital, Wisconsin. And she wrote about the awful reality that we live in, that our children in the city get shot frequently. And kind of the public health issue that it is.
Yeah. She's angry, and rightly so, because she's on the front line seeing these kids come in and day out in the ER after having been shot on purpose, having been shot by accident, you know, all because of guns.
Yes. Well, and as she talks about, many other issues, right?
Yeah.
Poverty, segregation, racism.
And lest you think, listeners, that this is going to be a terribly depressing conversation because of the subject matter, this is still a podcast about dreams, and it actually is a dreamy conversation. So make sure you get to the end, because I was left feeling hopeful. So
absolutely. Yeah, goosebumps at the end.
Yes, goosebumps.
Sure. With that, take it away.
Megan Schultz. Megan Schultz, we're not just having you on because our names are almost the same, which I love.
This isn't just a Megan Schultz podcast.
It's the Megan Schultz show.
There's a lot of us.
There are a lot of us. But, and we're not just having you on because your name is Megan, because our guest last week was Megan Johnson of Milwaukee Diaper Mission. Maybe you've heard of her or know her. But there are Megans are doing great things in Milwaukee, so we just have to showcase it. But you and I actually, we know each other. We have a mutual friend. We met at a party. But I had heard about you because of your op-eds that you wrote for the Journal Sentinel, which we will talk about. But you are an ER doctor, a pediatric ER doc at Children's Hospital, mother of
two.
Two. That's right. I couldn't remember if it was one or two. So mother of two, ER doc. I'm sure there are so many more titles to that, but we wanted to start with what we know about you, which is what we've read in your op-eds, doc. But you weren't always a doc. And so
no.
We wanted to just start with maybe having you tell our listeners who may not have read the op-eds, particularly the last one in September, and we'll link to all of these in our show notes, but maybe tell our listeners a little bit about how you got into being a doctor, where that came from, because you weren't always a doctor.
Yes, I took maybe a more circuitous route than others. I, from a very young age, knew I wanted to help people. And I think that was really role modeled well for me by my parents. They were foster parents. I had foster siblings growing up. My mom was a special education public school teacher. My grandma was a public school teacher. So I just kind of grew up in that world of, like, to those who are given much, much is expected. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I kind of thought it'd be cool to be a doctor. I liked the idea. And in high school, I actually shadowed a doctor. But I didn't know any doctors that looked like me or acted like me or... I don't know. I'm sort of outgoing and brash and female. And I didn't know doctors like that. A lot of the doctors I knew growing up who were awesome. I mean, great, great people tended to be older white men. And I didn't know if I could do it, to be honest. Mm-hmm. So I graduated college and I was an English and Spanish double major. And I went right from college into Teach for America, which for those of you who don't know what that is, it's sort of like a sister program to Peace Corps or AmeriCorps, where usually recent college graduates, although now they're taking really kind of any college graduate of any age, sign up to do 2 years of education, of teaching in a low-income public school somewhere in America. And I really like the idea of that. I didn't know where I was going to go. They kind of assign you, much like the Peace Corps. So they assigned me to Baltimore. They assigned me to teach Spanish. And I was at Frederick Douglass High School for 2 years. And I think that was so transformative in so many ways. I think I truly learned more from that experience than my students ever learned. And actually, I still know some of my students now, and I don't think they learned that much. But it was there that I, you know, so many of my students were really struggling with health, or their families were. You know, I would visit my students in their homes, and, you know, one of my students' mom had just had her leg amputated because of poorly controlled diabetes. Another of my students had an abortion that didn't go well. And then what came out in the Journal Sentinel article most recently was one of my students was shot. And it was kind of in visiting him at the Maryland Shock Trauma Center. He was there for a very long time. I just thought, I thought I could do this. I think I didn't have enough confidence before to like that I could be a physician. But after seeing how much Tori suffered and how much his family suffered and how much I just cared about it, I just thought, this is how I want to help kids. Like, teaching has been great. I love getting to know kids and like getting to know their families and filling this need. But I don't know, it just kind of spoke to me. I remember like specifically standing in his hospital room thinking like, no, I should be here. I should be doing this.
So the relationship with your students is what led you to the desire to be a doctor.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's always how it is. Like, I'm an empath. I really like getting to know people. And yeah, I feel like I have really strong relationships, even after like not getting to know, even after not that long, I feel like I end up coming away with like a really like deep connection sometimes. And that's how it was for a lot of my students.
Yeah. How does that translate to being a doc? Like, is it because, I mean, our healthcare system doesn't necessarily prioritize relationship building, which is the nice way to say it, right? How do you experience that as a ER doc at Children's? What kinds of relationships can you form?
That's a really interesting question because I was drawn to emergency medicine for a lot of reasons. One is that I'm sort of an adrenaline junkie. Two is that, you know, being exposed to kids like Tori who had been shot and had had an exorbitant amount of trauma, I felt like I was calm in traumatic situations. And so it was sort of a good personality fit. But then lastly, part of it was protective, you know, in residency. So like I did, you know, med school for 4 years, residency in pediatrics, where you just learn like everything about pediatrics. And then you have to do like a 3-year fellowship in pediatric emergency medicine after that. So in residency, I was doing like a primary care type of rotation. And I did get to know my patients for years, even. Like I remember one patient I had, I met her in the ICU at the hospital, but then became her primary care teacher and like got to know her over those next 2 or 3 years. And then I was her sibling's primary care doctor.
You said primary care teacher, which I think is so cool.
That is awesome.
Yeah. I just wanted to like note that.
Not the same, but there's a lot of overlap. That's hilarious.
Sure. Yeah, totally. Yeah. I love it.
So I was in the primary care clinic and it was hard. I couldn't do it. I think it was too sad for me. I thought that I was in a low income clinic. This is outside of Boston. The majority of the majority of my patients spoke Spanish. Many of them were recent immigrants or refugees. Many of them had gone through a lot of trauma, like before leaving their countries of origin. And I just felt like there were so many needs. I couldn't keep up with it. Some of them were hungry. Some of them had housing instability. Some of them were getting bullied at school. Some of them had ADD. Some of them were obese. Like it was too much for my little heart. Like the relationships were too strong. And I honestly feel like part of the reason I love the emergency room is because the relationships are self-contained. Like I have you in the ER for this one problem that I will do my best to solve, but it's for a discrete amount of time. And I recognize that you probably have many other issues, but I'm going to ask for help from social workers or teachers or nurses to kind of address these other things that I can't do it.
Mm, That's so wise. That's so wise to know your to know that that is a niche that you want to fill and that that's what your heart can hold. And
I mean, I have all the respect in the world for primary care doctors. It is an exhausting job.
I never thought about it like that. You're right, though. It is like when you mentioned all the things, that is very much like a school and like a teacher, and how schools and teachers are expected to not only just teach the reading, right, writing, and arithmetic, but also be the, you know, the cafeteria and the before school and after, you know, like all
right,
the
right.
all the wraparound services.
The counselor, the 100%. Mm-hmm. It's a lot.
I think it's also interesting to hear you say being a primary care doctor was too sad, so I had to go to emergency room doctoring in a poor segregated city where there's a shit ton of gun violence. Like, I want to hear about what brought you to Milwaukee specifically. And then, like, what culture shock did you get here? I think I know the answer to that, but I'd just be very curious to hear that in your own words, or like your story of it.
Yeah, I think I'm from Wisconsin.
Oh,
born and raised. And I'd been in Baltimore to teach, and I got my master's out there. And then I moved up to Boston. I worked for a global health organization for a couple of years. And then I met my husband, who's from the East Coast. And so we spent some time going back and forth between East Coast and Wisconsin, mostly just like for family reasons. Like, you know, I went to med school here in Wisconsin to be close to my family. And then I went to residency out in Boston to be close to his family. And so it was never, maybe it was obvious to others, but it was not obvious to me that we were going to end up in Wisconsin. I thought maybe we'd end up on the East Coast. But you know how hindsight is 2020. In retrospect, I cannot imagine working anywhere else. I think Wisconsin is such a unique place. I am so in love with it. I think, you know, we have a dozen federally recognized indigenous tribes here, which many, many other states do not. That was totally foreign in Massachusetts. When I asked about like Native and indigenous patients, they were like, what? Where? What are you talking about? Like, oh, okay. You guys don't do that here? You know, the Great Lakes. I think Milwaukee is so fascinating, honestly, like our industrial history, the Great Migration, how diverse we are now for like a relatively small city. And then Madison, I think, is also awesome. And just the university that's like world class and such a cool college town. And I just think Wisconsin's awesome. And specifically Milwaukee has just captivated me. You know, when I first moved here from Boston, it was a culture shock, as you said. Boston is a very rich city. Massachusetts has the highest physician density per capita of any state in the country. And that was just very obvious. Like, I mean, within the Boston city limits, there's like five hospitals or something. And Boston's not that much bigger, maybe even the same size as Milwaukee. So, you know, as a physician, selfishly, that you end up getting, your patients are diluted a lot. Like, oh, well, you know, this kind of patient goes to that hospital and this kind of patient goes to that one. And so every hospital kind of gets their own little, you know, I don't want that. I want to see everybody. So I liked coming to Milwaukee because, you know, Children's Wisconsin is like the only show in town. Like we get patients from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, from, you know, the far western reaches. We get from Northern Illinois, Iowa. So I liked that the catchment area was so big and that we got to see such a diverse array of patients. Like we will literally have like a kid from Northern Wisconsin who was ice fishing and got stuck with a fishing spear. And then the next, you know, moment we'll have a kid from right down the street who was shot at a park. And so I love that like diversity of patients. But then the other culture shock was just all the gun violence. You know, Massachusetts has much stronger gun legislation than Wisconsin does. And that was immediately obvious, even within the first week of being here. So many kids in Wisconsin have so much access to guns. Guns in their homes, there's guns in their parents' nightstands, there's guns in their grandma's purse, there's guns at school. Guns are everywhere here. And that took a lot of getting used to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you said in one of the articles, you said in your whole time in Boston, you had two or three kids come in with gunshot wounds, and here that happened in your first week.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's truly, I mean, and then I work a lot in global health now too. That's one of my other hats I wear. And it shocks other people. When you talk about what happens in a place like Milwaukee with the amount of gun violence we see, It is incomprehensible to physicians in other places. And I wish more people knew that. You know, I'll talk to a Canadian ER doctor, a Canadian pediatric ER doctor who had the same training as me, works in the same kind of children's hospital as me. He will have never seen a shot child his entire life in 30 years. He's like, I don't even know what I would do. You know, like, what? How do you treat something like that? And, you know, we see on average 3 a week here. 3 a week. That is like 1 every other day. How did we get here? How do we stop this? And how are we not just like embarrassed by that? Just at a global scale. Like,
yeah.
So on a global level, other doctors can't relate. What about in the
relate.
What about in the US? Do you like, what are other cities like in the US?
So I think that in states where there's high education levels and good gun legislation, like Massachusetts, it is also incomprehensible.
Yeah.
Boston's, you know, when I talk to my colleagues at where I trained at Mass General, they still do not see as a lot of gun violence. But if you look at cities that have a similar history of Milwaukee, of, you know, poverty, segregation, community violence, racism, yeah, they're seeing it too. Like, you know, I think we've seen that a lot with like, after George Floyd's murder, I think there's been more media placed on like community violence, police violence, segregation, racism, structural racism, and cities where that those things thrive, you're going to see a lot of gun violence.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So this is a podcast about dreams. My guess is that you and many of our listeners have a very similar dream for our city, for our world. And maybe even people who are not so hip to the gun legislation conversation, right? I want to like, what is in the simplest terms, what is the dream that you are working toward?
Okay, I want to let you know, if I cry, it's not a bad thing. It's just how I express emotion.
Tears are 100% welcome.
So you will not be the first. That is okay.
Okay, good. I just feel very deeply. I mean, I have a lot of dreams. One of my biggest dreams, and I think the one I work toward every day, is that all children, regardless of zip code or location or color of their skin, have access to an excellent education and excellent healthcare. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why I became a teacher. I think that's why I became a doctor. And I think that's why I now do global health. I don't think it's fair that just based on where you live or based on where you were born, your shot in life is so royally screwed sometimes. I don't think that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. So that's my big picture dream. I think in little ways that pops up all over the place. You know, like, that's why I send my kids to public school. That's why I was a foster parent. That's why I vote the way I vote. That's why, you know, I travel abroad and like work in limited resource settings. I think this is an achievable goal. I think we as a planet have the resources, and we just need to be a little kinder to each other.
Mm. And I feel like in reading your op-eds, you have the answers too. It's like, hello, people, we can solve this. Here, bullet point 1, 2, 3, and 4. This is what we need to do. Come
I
on.
Mean, they're so complex. I definitely do not have all the answers. It's so many of these things. Like, my brother and I talk about this a lot. He was an airborne combat medic in Afghanistan twice. He did 2 tours of duty in Afghanistan. And then he was a public school teacher. Then he went and taught public school in Milwaukee Public Schools. So he and I have talked about how, you know, like, any question you have, any problem you're having, you have to ask 7 whys to get to the answer. So like, you know, if my problem is public schools in Milwaukee, which like break my heart, right? Like, I don't think those kids are getting a good shake right now. Well, why? Why is it like that? Well, part of it is funding. I don't think MPS is funded very well. Why? Well, a lot of that had to do with like taxation and how taxes for public schools are based on property. Why? Well, a lot of that has to do with voting and legislation. And how, so these problems are very complex. You often have to ask 7 whys to get to the nugget. And then the answers are often like really interlocking, you know? Mm. And so I think it's going to take a very interdisciplinary group to tackle each one of these problems, but we could do it. We're smart.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that a lot of us get stuck at it's too complex. too many steps. It's too complicated. I don't know enough. I will say something wrong. I will do something wrong. And then we don't do anything.
100%. I get a lot of hate mail anytime I write an op-ed about gun violence. I always hear about it. Sometimes there, I get support, letters of support, like very, very kind, wonderful letters of support who are like, yes, we need better gun control. But then sometimes I get hate mail. And the hate mail, well, a lot of it is racist, to be honest, which is annoying. But then a lot of it is kind of to that point of like, you know, gun laws aren't going to fix it. Okay, well, then what do you think is, and let's try that thing. we're going to need to do something because this is not working. So maybe it's like my ER mentality of like, you know, you know, in the ER, we almost never have all of the answers laid out in front of us when we choose a treatment. A kid comes in sick and we're like, holy shit, let's try to treat it like sepsis and see if that works.
And
then, if that doesn't work, then we'll go down the other path. So that's where I am with big monumental problems like gun violence. Like, well, the best bet based on the research is less guns. So let's try that thing first. And after like 20 years, if we're still in the same boat, we'll try something else. Or let's try a bunch of things at once. And like, best case scenario, one of them works. Like, fantastic. But yeah, yes. I don't deal well with the like, oh, it's never going to happen. Or, oh, it's just too hard. Or like, nothing else has worked. If you are not going to help do anything, like, just get out of here.
Yeah, I'm really like struck by the brilliance in, you know, ER medicine is 100% one of those like impossible, you know, that there's going to be failure, you know, that you're not going to, it's not going to work every time, but we need to have it, right? Mm-hmm. If we don't have it, we're in a worse place than having something, right? So I love that approach. And I think it's just really valuable to have that mindset to something like this, this complexity. So I selfishly want to know what is working. What do we need to put our attention? Because I am in the same boat. My dream is for a world where people experience safety, and Milwaukee is not a place where people experience safety, specifically if you are poor, specifically if you're a person of color, but many of us don't experience safety when there's, you know, shootings happening or car racing happening or whatever, right? So I'm with you on the dream, and I want to know how to funnel my energy towards those things that are working. So what do you see working?
Yeah,
or is that above your pay grade? Like, are you like, I don't know, I've handed that off to, which is 100% fine because my kid is probably going to need some of your services soon, and I'm glad that you're doing that.
Call me up, girl. Yeah, I don't know all the answers for sure. I think I work with brilliant people, though, who have some good ideas. I think, you know, one thing that has been shown to work nationally over and over again is less guns. So something I just even struggle with, like on a peer-to-peer level, is anxiety. There's so much anxiety among parents and adults in general. Now it's kids, too. I mean, everyone's anxious. And I think there's a belief, this mythical belief, like if we arm ourselves, we'll be safer. And that is just categorically false. Like, we know that from years of research. If you have a gun in your home, you are less safe. If you have a gun in your home, you are more likely to die of gun homicide or suicide than someone who does not have a gun in their home. So we know that guns make you less safe. So that's something that I, you know, just even people in my own family who think that they're safer with a gun, I talk to them about that. Like, no, statistically, you are less safe. And then I also am kind of a stickler. Like, if I don't let my kids go into homes with guns. So that's my own family. That's people, you know, their friends. I always ask, just like a lot of parents will ask, like, oh, any allergies? I think we need to be asking, are there any guns in the home? Because that statistically is more likely to kill your child than an allergy. Guns are the number one killer of children. So how do we keep them away from guns?
And is it as simple? I often sometimes with these kinds of things love hearing how other parents actually say it. Is it just like, hey, just calling to, got any guns in your closet? Like, how, like, if I wanted a script, like, how do you say that? What do you?
This is a really great question. I actually worked on this with my therapist, because yes, I have a therapist. She's fantastic. Yes. And I was like, is this nuts? Like, am I being too anxious? I don't want to look like a crazy lady. And she's very wise. And she was like, one, it's not anxious if it's based in fact. Are guns the number one killer of children? And I was like, yes. And she's like, great. That's not anxious then. That's fact. And I was like, excellent point. And she was like, two, you know, you just say it in a matter of fact way that you would about anything else that you ask. So like, you know, I'll commonly, if like my kids are going over someone's home, oh, do you have dogs? Like, how are they with kids? Like that kind of thing. I'll just say it like that. Like, you know, we haven't been to your house yet. Things I always ask parents when we go over for the first time, like, does anyone have any allergies we should know about? And are there any guns in the home? And sometimes the answer is, oh, no guns in the home. Sometimes the answer is like, oh my God, thanks for asking. Like, I never thought about that. I should ask that. But sometimes the answer is yes, there are. And then my follow-up question is, okay, how are they stored? And it's up to everyone's personal, what you feel comfortable with. Some people don't want to go be in any homes with any kind of guns stored any kind of way. Other people, you know, might feel comfortable if the guns are in a locked cabinet and the ammunition is in a separate locked cabinet and no one knows, you know, the combinations. But then some people will say like, oh no, it's locked and loaded under my bed. Okay, well then I'm so sorry, like we can't come over. You can come to our house.
Yeah.
And then a follow-up question to this. What ages are your kids, and like how, at what point does, I mean, what are your standards? I'm just going to follow the Dr. Schultz recommendations here from my own family.
My kids are like preschool and grade school.
Okay.
They both definitely know what to do if they see a gun. So I have like taught them extensively that guns are not safe. If they ever see a gun, they should back away and get a grown up, because I've seen this in the ER where, I mean, kids find guns all the time and they're cool and they're weird and they're on TV and like they make a big noise. I mean, kids play with guns all the time. So my kids definitely know what to do if they see a gun, which is like get away from it and go find a grown-up. And then me personally, I feel comfortable if a parent or someone in my family says, okay, like we have guns for hunting or whatever, the guns are locked up over here and the kids don't know the combination and the ammunition is over here, or we don't have ammunition in the home or something, I feel fine with that. Because there are, I mean, I will, and I'm trying to be like less biased about this, like there is a culture of hunting in our state, and that can be totally safe and fine if stored properly. And there's like a respect. I mean, I even know like police officers who have guns in their homes with their children because they have to, it's like part of their job, but I need a respect for that weapon from the grown up. You know what I mean? Like, so I've talked to police officers or their spouses who are like, yeah, we have a gun in the home because of my, you know, profession, but it is stored in this area and because my kids are here and they know this and this. Like if there's been a conversation in the home about the weapon and it's stored appropriately and there's like a serious respect and fear for that weapon, okay, fine.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I grew up with guns in our house because of hunting, because I grew up on a farm, and like was how dad took care of, I don't know, badgers and things. Sorry, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because I don't know that we ever had a conversation about it. I don't remember that, but I do remember having great respect for it. Like that is used to kill things, and therefore
don't touch it.
I don't touch it. Right.
Yes.
And I don't think it was locked up, but I don't think I knew where ammunition was. You know, I don't think it had ammo in it and all that. So it does, like, these are very commonsensical things. But what I'm hearing you say is that not everybody shares that level of respect for guns. And kids are playing with guns regularly in our city.
Yes, 100%. Like the number of times I've seen, like, you know, a 12-year-old goes to a sleepover and the sleepover house has a gun, and then all the 12-year-olds play with it and someone gets shot. Or mom bought a gun because she's a single mom and she's scared of her neighborhood or whatever. But then, you know, maybe because she's scared, it's based out of anxiety, doesn't talk about it with the kids. And then the kid finds it on her dresser, and that's that.
So what can legislation do about those kinds of problems?
So there are safe storage laws that could be passed where, you know, in situations like I just talked about, it would be parents' liability. If a child were to find a gun and use it, that would be on the parents. I think we do need legislation like that, just at least to get the conversation started or to get parents thinking about it. Ideally, it would be like when you purchase this gun, it also comes with this gun safe or you know, this lock, and then you have to have both. I am nervous about the idea of like punishing people who don't need punishment for something that's already terrible. Like we've definitely had families in the ER who like a parent accidentally shot at one of their children and then goes to prison for it. And I don't know if that's going to help anybody. Like, then all of a sudden a parent is in prison, and like, we all know how that devastates families. And I'm sure that parent feels terrible, and I don't know that prison is going to make them feel any different. So I get nervous about sort of criminalizing parents who don't need to be over-criminalized. Mm-hmm. However, I think if we had laws where it was just easier, like a lot of pediatrics is just doing the right thing because it's easier. So like, you know, the ramps on sidewalks, those are made for people in wheelchairs, but they're easier for everyone to get up the curb. So we all use them. Like, that is how I would love to see gun legislation. This, you know, gun locks and boxes are free, or you get them when you purchase your gun, or, you know, anytime. We have a new emergency department. It just opened last Thursday. We now have weapon screening for the first time ever. We found a lot of weapons right away, mm-hmm. first day of use, which I think also speaks to the point of how many people are armed, and we just had no idea. But I think, you know, if we have things in place that, again, don't criminalize, but make it easy. So like, if we do find a weapon on you, like, can we get you registered for that weapon? Can we can we get you this gun safe, and you could put it in your car in a locked safe way? Like, I just wish we had the resources and interest to make the safe choice the easy choice.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, even just thinking about, like, I'm a coach, and I think a lot about habit building. And, you know, we are creatures of comfort and ease. And if it's complicated, we don't do it. And 100%. So how do you make it as easy as possible to keep guns out of kids' hands? Yeah, that's a really fascinating approach. What states are getting it right? What places are getting it right? Do you know? Or who knows?
I always go to every town for their research. They have funded research. It will show you state by state with like bar graphs. And then you can even break it down by like which legislation is most effective.
Mm. Okay. Let's put a link to that. We'll put a link to that in our show notes.
You can look up, they grade each state too. Wisconsin does not have a very high grade.
Well, and in your op-ed from, which one was it? Was it the one in June of this year? You have like over 140 doctors who have signed this
plea. A call for action.
Yes.
It wasn't just doctors, actually. This was like one of my favorite parts of doing that was, it was like everybody. We had like nurses, respiratory therapists, the health unit coordinators who answer the phones in the ER. Like, we had so many people sign that. And I just thought that was so beautiful. Like, look at this extremely diverse group of people who all want Milwaukee to be safer for children.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you list, mm-hmm. you know, you have four bullet points of things that our legislators can and should do immediately, right? So even though it's not going to solve the whole problem by just passing these four things, it's a start, right? Yeah,
exactly.
And so are these things, and I'm just going to say them because I think they're important. Require background checks on all gun sales, restrict domestic abusers from owning guns, allow family members and law enforcement to temporarily remove guns from unsafe individuals in crisis, and prohibit assault weapons and high capacity magazines. This is something that, like, our listeners, for example, could shoot off an email to their legislator saying, I support these, please.
These are evidence-based. They are research-driven. Like you said, we had hundreds of people sign on to these things who cover every part of the political spectrum. This is really not politically biased. It's political because it's based on policy, but it's politically non-biased. These are just the right choice for safety. Those laws have been proven to work in other states. Part of what's making Wisconsin lacking right now, there's a gap in Wisconsin safety, and I think those laws could really help.
Yeah.
Awesome.
What I would be interested in, and Shelley, maybe this is something we consider for the podcast, is actually getting a legislator on here to say, okay, what happens when you get those emails? You know, like, if you're a, if you're a legislator who isn't going to pass these things, or this isn't high priority for you, and you get an email from me, citizen, you know, Joe, do you do anything with it? Does it go right to the garbage bin? You know, like, because sometimes it can feel, as a citizen who knows nothing about this and who is not legislature, that, like, I don't know, is anybody really going to listen if I take the time out of my day to do that? But I think they probably are. And it would be good to hear from that. But I think, you know, I hope anyway, that having 140 plus people on this plea is something that they wake up to and that they say, oh, wait a minute. Yeah. And do you have any sense? Do you see any traction right now?
I heard from some representatives who already believe in this after that, just like via email or Twitter. I think another thing, you know, when we get to the seven whys, another thing that probably needs to change is how legislators are funded. There's a lot of funding in all levels of government from pro-gun groups, mm-hmm. including the NRA. Mm-hmm. And I think as long as legislators are allowed to accept money from pro-gun groups, there's not going to be any gun legislation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is a sticking point, isn't it? Yeah. And I love that you identify that a key belief that keeps us in that place is anxiety about our safety and getting to that myth that mm-hmm. like more guns will keep us safe when in fact evidence shows that more guns does not keep us safe. This just keeps happening.
There's so much anxiety right now. And I don't know if it's, I see it all the time in the ER from every part of the family, not just the patient. I don't know if COVID really turned us on our heads or if social media is doing it, or, I mean, there is just escalating fear in general about like climate change and global conflict. But yeah, a lot of people are really anxious, and it helps me because a lot of times that anxiety ends up looking like anger. And yeah. So it helps me to try to think objectively about that. Like, where is this coming from? And is this really directed at me, or is it really directed at this topic, or is this coming from like an anxious place? And that sometimes I'm able to get to a more empathic place towards people by thinking like, oh, I bet they're really anxious.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and so much anxiety is, starts from trauma and having nervous systems that are formed in situations of intense, persistent chronic trauma. And I would venture to say that in this country, a lot of us experience trauma in various ways because of, well, and even just in our world, the amount of suffering that we witness because of technology, because of our ability to know everything about everybody in every part of the globe, right? That like as human bodies, are we designed to take on that much suffering on the daily?
Yeah, no, definitely not.
And so what do we do with it?
One of the downsides.
It turns into chronic stress and anxiety, which is killing us. Either because we buy guns and have them in our house unsafely, or because we get hypertension and diabetes and, you know, all the things. So that is an interesting point to make. Like, that's one thing that I feel like we could be more serious about is like, how do I come into an experience of safety and get in touch with that for myself? What does that look like for me? Like actual safety. And that's work that all of us can do with ourselves and our kids, right? To really like get serious about like, okay, it's real to feel anxious about the world out there. And how can we find places of safety and like amp that up in our life? Yeah. Is that something you think about regularly or not? Like, is that woo-woo?
I think about it a lot because I see so much trauma and sadness. I mean, I could cry every shift if I had the time. In some parts, it's not even like the big level violent stuff. Sometimes it's just very small quotidian stuff, but it's the amount of suffering that is out there that can become very oppressive. Like, you know, in one shift, I'll have a girl come in who's pregnant but doesn't want me to tell their parents. A girl who ran away from her group home because they took away her iPad and she has no family and like no one else to go to. A boy who's cutting himself. You know, a little baby who was abused by mom's boyfriend. I mean, it's this all in like one 8-hour shift. And it can feel very, very, very heavy.
Yeah.
So yes, I think about this a lot. And I think one thing that, there's a couple things that help me. One is that I feel like I'm doing something about them. I feel purpose-driven. I feel like I'm doing my best to address a lot of other people's grief and suffering. Number two, maybe isn't very mature, but anger is helpful. For those of you who have read those op-eds I've written, almost all of them were like written from a place of anger.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, rightly so.
That kids are getting shot. Like, this makes me angry. This is stupid.
That is a very legitimate response.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anger is a very appropriate response to that.
Right?
Yes.
And even honestly, writing was helpful. Like, that was something to do with my anger. Like, that it was an active choice I made. Like, I am so angry right now. I'm going to write about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But then the other thing is, and this is pretty woo-woo, I think was the word you used. But
technical term, evidence-based.
Yes. Link to this in the show notes, please. No, the other thing is like trying my best, and I'm not always good at this, to notice this very small, beautiful connections between people.
Oh.
And those happen all the time too. And I'm talking about very small. Like, you know, I was working in the ER the other day, and one of the like environmental services people, like the cleaners, saw me and was like, "I read your article. I read your article. That was so beautiful."
Oh.
I don't know. I didn't know her name, but I just thought that was so beautiful that like she sought me out and that we were able to connect on this one thing. But it can be even smaller. Like, you know, when I was at the airport recently and I called my husband like crying because I was like so touched by how kind people were at the airport to each other. Like, you know, like standing in line and like letting someone skip them, or like, oh, you can't reach that. Like, I'll get that. Let me get that like suitcase in that area for you or whatever. That I think is the point. I think that those small examples of us being kind to each other, it can be the antidote to anxiety, can be the antidote to suffering. There are millions of beautiful moments happening all around us. Mm-hmm. And if we can notice those, I think we'll be okay.
Mm.
Mic drop. I know you don't have a mic, but if you did,
earpod drop.
You did. And you know, what I notice about that, it's kindness, and it's like connection with people who you have no reason to connect to, really. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yes.
But like seeing the humanity in the people around us just because they are humans. Yes.
100%.
Mm.
I was at Goodwill the other day, and I love going to Goodwill for used books. They have like amazing books, so they're like $2. And I was at Goodwill, and this guy, he was maybe like a 55-year-old guy. He's black. He was at Goodwill. He was like, "Dude, I love your shoes." And I was like, "Oh, that's so nice. I love these shoes too." And that like put me in a good mood. That's the day, just that we had that like very tiny connection about something. I thought that was so cool.
Yeah.
Well, and I think if you take that that concept that you were talking about, like the whys, going back 7 whys, if we go back 7 times for all of what we do in this world, isn't it just that we all want to be seen and we all want to matter, we all want to belong, right? So I feel like these tiny little glimmers, I think they're called. I feel like I heard this word being described as a little, looking for glimmers. And you know, we have triggers on the negative things that trigger us. But the glimmers of this, these just tiny little moments of joy and connection and community. Mm-hmm. And isn't really that what the dream is, you know, if we take it back 7 times?
Yeah.
7 times.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing that's on my mind around that is like, our bodies are always scanning for threat and safety. That's I'm doing a bunch of like geeking out on nervous system stuff lately. And I love this idea that our bodies are constantly scanning for threat and safety. And some of us are more geared to looking for the threat because of nervous systems that were formed in environments that were threatening. And that led to our survival. So good on you that you survived this, and you're going to die because of all of the stress hormones that are flooding your body all the time. Our bodies also scan for safety. And so I've like, how can I be the safest, most welcoming person out there in the world so that people pick up on cues of safety as opposed to threat? Like, that's the kind of person I want to be in the world.
Mm-hmm.
One that walks around and just has like a sense of like, And honestly, I'm failing at this big time because my life is a big stress ball of all the things that I got to do all the time. Get this kid there, get that kid there. You know, I'm stressing out right now about the damn school photo things that have to be back tomorrow. And one of them got, you know, like just stupid shit.
Yeah.
And I put that all in perspective and like, okay, that's taking away from my ability to be a peaceful, loving presence in the world that desperately needs safe and loving people.
Yeah.
Right. And so what do I need to do in tiny, tiny ways to make my life less stress ballish? Again, another evidence-based word. And, you know, be able to be that loving present, who's present person, who's able to compliment the person in goodwill on their shoes. Mm. Right. Or able to thank somebody that in my workplace who did something brave, you know, those are huge. Those are really tiny moments, but man, it's such a huge shift to try to make in the world that we live in today.
Mm. Well, and I think being at doc, like one of my, and I know we're getting, we want to be mindful of your time because you have a shift, but you know, one of the questions was like, is it a dreamy job? I mean, you're dealing with kids who are coming in with bullets and, you know, all the things you just mentioned that could happen in an 8-hour shift. Is that dreamy? But maybe the dreamy part is getting to be the safety and getting to be that person who makes these tiny little connections and who.
I just got goosebumps.
Yes.
That is exactly it. You nailed it. Yeah. Like it's a really hard job. I mean, I cry a lot, as we've discussed. I talk to my mom a lot. I have a therapist. Like, it's a very hard job.
Yeah.
However, the privilege of being allowed into people's lives at their hardest and most horrific moments is so beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I am not a religious person. I am atheist. So I tend to believe that everything we have is here right now. And so I just think this is spiritual. Like, I think this work is spiritual. Mm. And I'm not always good at it. Like, I don't want to like pretend I have it all figured out. I'm definitely stressed. I definitely like snap at my kids all the time. There are definitely patients in the ER who like really annoy me. So like, I am still very much figuring this out, but I do love my job. I do think it's dreamy. I think I am lucky to have it. I think I am working on my goals every day, my goals of education and healthcare and safety for children. And that's, that feels good.
Yeah. Love it. Love it.
Thank you for being you and being, this is just really inspiring, like really, really, truly inspiring. So thank you. Do you have a couple minutes more to do the wrap? Yeah, we have some like fun questions. not all of this is like totally fun in a like capital F maybe kind of way. But we do have some fun ones like, Megan, I don't have it up right now. I can't find
I do. Okay. What is the craziest thing you've ever pulled out of a kid's nose? or body or stomach. I don't know, wherever you else you pull through, but
yeah, it's not just noses. They put stuff everywhere. Oh my God. What haven't I pulled out? I mean, Legos, pencil erasers, and like hair beads are probably the most common.
Mm.
My favorite is when the kid is there for like, you know, that stomach, and I just happen to look in the ear and I'm like, oh, did you know there's a crane in here? And then the mom's like, what? And the kid's like, yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
That's great. So when you're not pulling tiny objects out of kids' orifices, where can we find you? How do you spend your time?
I like bike rides. I like beer gardens. I really like to travel. I went to Kenya in July for work. My family and I went to Italy in March for fun. And then I read my Goodwill books, basically. That's it.
Awesome.
What is the wisest piece of wisdom that has ever come from one of your patients, one of your kids, you know, or most poignant or something that you remember, like a patient that you're like, oh.
My God. I mean, kids are so wonderful. I also think I would be very, very burned out if I didn't take care of kids. I think kids just innately are hopeful and like represent the future, and they so often get better. And even when they're sick, they still want to play. Like, that is such a cool part of my job. I think if I were like an adult doctor, I would not be as happy as so thank you, adult doctors.
Well, that's wise in and of itself, just that resilience and the hopefulness.
The resilience is incredible. Like I remember recently we had a really tough diagnosis of like probably terminal cancer. And I was working with a resident who are like, you know, they're training to be doctors. They've graduated med school, but they're like in their kind of hands-on training phase. And the resident was really nervous about like kind of how to break the news. And the kid was young enough, like kind of preschoolish age, that like, you know, is not going to understand much of what we're saying, but the parents are going to get it. Mm. So the resident was super just, you know, anxious about how to break this news, and appropriately so. You want to do it right. But they ended up saying like, why not, can you just do it so I can see what it looks like? So sure. So I went in, and I try not to say much during bad conversations. I try to just to like give a little bit of info and then like allow for silence. Because like no one really is listening to you after, you know, they're freaking out.
Yeah.
So I pretty much did that. And the parents had their response, and the kid was like, can I finally eat now? Because they had been like, you know, they couldn't eat for like while we were getting imaging or something. And it just immediately like lightened the mood. And I think, you know, people went from crying to laughing. And I was like, yes, sweetheart. Like, can I get you mac and cheese? Like, what, chicken fingers? Like, what is on the menu for you tonight? So we got the kids some food. And then, you know, she wanted to color. So we got her some coloring books. And like, you know, it's very, very sad. And I certainly do not mean to say that that was, you know, an easy situation. It was horrible. But I think kids, you know, they're so in the moment. Like, I think that's what I've learned the most from working with kids, even my own kids, is like, they're never anxious about the thing that's going to happen in 6 years or the thing that's happening across the world. Like, they just really want to eat some chicken fingers right now. Mm-hmm. And I think that's wise to a certain extent, you know, like, yeah, how can we be happy in this moment? Like, what should we be focusing on actually right now?
Yeah. A lesson for all of us. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for that. Okay. The last question that we always ask folks is, this is a podcast about amazing Milwaukee women. And we want to know from the amazing Milwaukee women who are other Milwaukee women who are living the dream, doing dreamy things. Inspiring you. So somebody in Milwaukee that's inspiring you right now.
There's like so many of us, aren't there? I love people here.
I mean, we have a whole podcast about it.
Right? Well, you already know Maura Flaherty, who I think is fantastic. She's just like kicking ass at being a lawyer. And like, you know what I love about Maura too is like, she's very confident in her abilities, but in a very understated way. Mm-hmm. Like she just got this huge new job and she was like, yeah, it's a pretty big deal. I'll be supervising like 2 dozen people. I love her. She's inspiring. A lot of women I work with are inspiring. There's a physician assistant named Madeline Nguyen, who is born and raised in Milwaukee and is now, she just got like funding and support from Children's to like address social determinants of health in the ER, which is a new role. It's never been done, but Maddie has been like fearless in, we screen all patients in the ER for hunger. We set them up with free food when they're in the ER, and then we connect them with a community navigator afterwards. And Maddie has done all of that by herself, basically. She's awesome.
Love that.
Dr. Michelle Pickett is also a Milwaukee woman born and raised. She works a lot with adolescents and STIs. And I don't, little known fact, but STIs are rampant in this city, y'all.
Wow.
Syphilis, like for a while, we were like in the top three cities in the country for syphilis. So Dr. Pickett is fantastic. She like has the hard conversations with adolescents that like no one else wants to, you know, about like pregnancy and sex and like even like anal sex or weird stuff that you would never talk about with your parents. Like Dr. Pickett's on it. She's fantastic.
Nice. Very cool. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you for living this dream and doing what you do for Milwaukee and our children and our gun legislation. Listen up, legislators.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you for helping me cry this morning. It was a good cry.
Oh, yay.
Reminds me, it reminds me, now, you know, I'm gonna have a good shift now. It reminds me why I'm doing it. So thank you.
Yeah. I love that purpose driven, man. That's huge. And that I think that's a part of why we do this podcast is like to get people in touch with like what gives you reason to be here, you know, what are you working towards? And let's get after it. Let's get after
Yeah,
it.
what makes you
So
angry enough to do something about something?
yeah.
So, yeah, thank
Yeah.
you for what you're doing.
Awesome. All right. Well, have a great shift. And
Yes.
I hope I don't see you.
Yeah. I'll
I'll see you at a dinner party, but not in the
Good.
ER,
Yeah, not
please.
the R.
Sounds
Yeah.
good.
All
See you at
right.
Goodwill.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I found myself reflecting on this interview long after our conversation.
Yeah.
You know, for a problem that's so big, I just love this idea that like we just have to start somewhere, people, and not just like bandaging up the wounds, but wow, what can we do to prevent the wounds from happening?
Yeah, and she's got ideas. There are evidence-based things that we can do out there.
Yeah. And
So,
proof, other cities
yeah.
that have done things, other countries that have done things,
Yeah.
ways that we in our own personal lives can impact this, right?
For sure.
Keep our kids safe and help other people in the world feel safer. Live with less anxiety. Wouldn't that be nice?
That would be dreamy. That would be a dreamy world. So hopefully you were inspired to reach out to a legislator of yours, let them know how you feel about this issue. Even just one small step. Parents, double checking with your friends before play dates. That was something I'm going to take away for sure. But just the little things that you can do, and hopefully this episode inspired you to think about what those things could be.
Absolutely.
Small steps, big change. That's what we need,
Let's do
friends.
it, Milwaukee. Let's do it.
Tune in next week when we have another incredible Milwaukee woman on this podcast.
Ooh, yes. Next week is a fun one. Lori Frederick on Milwaukee Food Writer.
A delicious conversation. Can't wait.
Aha.
Until next week, Milwaukee.
Keep on dreaming.
Keep on dreaming.